The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Fourth Circuit. We have three cases on the calendar for this afternoon, and we'll begin with United States versus Leggins. And Mr. Gavin, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you. Judges and Mr. Wang, may it please the court. I represent Chukwesi Leggins. My name is Charles Gavin. We have three primary arguments. The first argument is based on sufficiency of the evidence, and because I believe that's Mr. Leggins' best argument, I'm going to try to spend a little time with that. My thought and my argument is that the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law to convict Mr. Leggins on count five. The more specific argument is that the government failed to establish substantial credible evidence that the specific sexual act, which was alleged in count five, actually occurred. If it didn't occur, then there's no evidence to establish that it was false. If it was not a false statement, or if it was not established, then the falsity element of 1001 could not be established. To further dial in on that, my argument is that, in particular, there was no specific, substantial, credible evidence that supported the finding of penetration. And penetration was required because it was contained as part of the definition of sexual act upon which the conviction was based. There were two statements, and both of those statements were predicated on the existence of a sexual act, which would have required penetration. So for the evidence that applied to penetration, there were essentially two components. The first component was the victim's testimony. The second component was the physical evidence and the scientific evidence that was recovered in a rape kit exam that happened after the incident alleged to have happened on May 10th of 2018. So in looking at the scientific evidence first, you see that right after the incident, the victim was transported to St. Mary's, and an extensive rape kit was done and analyzed. And you know, most importantly, nothing was shown, nothing was found. There was not one evidence or evidentiary item that established that there was a tear in the victim's anus, not so much as a skin cell broken, no subjective evidence of pain. There was nothing to support any penetration at all. The best and most significant piece of evidence for the United States was the existence of DNA somewhere around the victim's anus, but we don't know where, and we don't know how it got there. We don't know when it got there, and we don't know the medium in which it was transported there. So there is evidence that there is DNA there, but there was nothing else to substantiate the allegation of actual penetration. There was no internal test done because there was the evidence, frankly, was so inadequate that an internal test was not even justified by the examiner at the time. There
Mr.
was no
Gavin,
other.
Can I ask you? The eyewitness, the victim testified to the sexual act. We can't take that testimony by itself as being sufficient.
Well, that would be the second component, Judge Diaz. And I was going to the next part was, is that substantial and credible? You know, the jury acquitted the defendant of four other counts that were based on the victim's direct testimony, which they obviously discredited as incredible. If you look at the specific testimony in regards to the May 10th incident, you know, the testimony is so over-exaggerated, it's incredible. And I say that specifically, the victim indicated under oath in affidavit almost immediately after this that he was forcefully and anally raped for 5 minutes in and of itself in that office room back on May 10th. The entire time that they were back in that corridor, which we know, does not rely on his credibility, was 315 seconds. That's the time they entered the corridor until the time they exited. I introduced an expert, not an expert, but an investigator who testified that just the simple act of walking from one place to the next and exiting would have taken up 70 of those 315 seconds. So what the defendant in his version has alleged is that he was forced to go back into the office room. He was forced to perform oral sex on the defendant for a period of time, after which they then moved to a different section of the room after which he was forcibly anally raped for 5 minutes, according to the victim, after which they cleaned up, after which Mr. Leggins had to go to the restroom, and then after which they departed the other side. Now, according to that version, all of that would have had to happen in less than 4 minutes, which is just simply incredible. And that's what I was able to argue to the jury. And I believe that is what the jury agreed with me upon, is that it just didn't happen. So if it didn't happen, then the evidence from the victim's side can't really be considered as credible in light of the absence of any physical evidence that would corroborate that. So, Judge Diaz, I would say to you, not only that the physical evidence to support it, but the actual testimony of the victim is not substantial or credible enough, specifically and especially in light of the jury's verdict on the other four substantive accounts, to render his testimony credible.
Now, you mentioned the verdicts, and admittedly, they're, you know, they, at least at first blush, they do tend to be inconsistent, but I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why a jury might acquit on one count and convict on the other. You know, what leads you to believe that the primary reason for the acquittal was that the jury simply didn't believe the victim's testimony?
Well, you know, are you going to gore my oxen or Mr. Wang's oxen? I think under the Lauthien case. But, you know, I agree that the case law still is out there, that an inconsistent verdict does not necessarily win me the day. But even though it does not win me the day, I think to gore my ox, you still have to establish, and the government was required to establish, that there was substantial credible evidence that the underlying offense took place. And that takes me back to whether or not there was actual penetration. Because if there was no actual penetration or no established substantial credible evidence to establish penetration, then the falsity element was never established, and he should have been acquitted of count five.
Well, I may have just absolutely misunderstood this case. I thought the key issue in here was the Apprendi issue and Eileen, in that the indictment did not contain any allegation about the enhancement. And that in order for him to be subjected to it, that's an element that the jury would have had to find. I mean, isn't that the real issue in this case?
That's the second issue of the case, Judge Floyd. And the issue arose out of the fact that after the verdict was in, Judge Novak realized that the arraignment on the record was 5 years, and based on the 5-year standard 1001 penalty. But then based on it being a sexual act, quote unquote, that would have subjected the defendant to an 8-year penalty. So it's an issue of whether or not he constructively amended the indictment, or whether he just failed to instruct the jury as he should have to include that extra element. Because I agree that the indictment does contain the basic elements for a 1001 offense, but under Apprendi, in order to convict the defendant of a crime that would have increased his level or to an 8-year max, then the actual wording of that relates it to a chapter offense under 209A would have had to have been included and would have had to have been established as an element in the actual trial.
Mr. Gavin, can I ask a follow up to that? So, but and I get your point that you say that the evidence simply was insufficient to prove a sexual act. But if we disagree with you and conclude that the jury did in fact find that a sexual act was committed by your client, doesn't that answer the factual question that Apprendi is concerned about? I mean, the question as to whether or not the offense relates to one under Chapter 109 seems to me to be a purely legal one, that it wasn't necessarily or should not have been necessarily part of the jury's calculus.
Well, Judge, if I understand your question, as I understand the law, if it's going to increase the maximum from 5 to 8, then it's an element that has to be submitted to the jury. And it's
no, I don't disagree with that. The question is exactly what was it that the jury had to find? That they had to find both that, you know, a sexual act was committed, and then, you know, the obvious connection then follows inevitably that it was in fact that offense relates to chapter 109. There simply can't be any dispute about that. Or do they have to find both?
They have to find both. That's my argument. They have to find that the sexual act was committed, otherwise it wasn't false. They also have to find that the offense was specifically related to 109A, and that was not given to them. The instruction.
Okay, can I follow up on that? Because it seems like words matter here. And you use the word offense is related to 109A, but I read 1001 to say that the matter must be related to 109A. And I read matter to refer to the investigation, not the crime. Is that not the right way to read that portion of 1001?
Judge Richard, I would agree with you. That was a poor choice of words on my part, but it's still at the end of the day.
Help me understand if that matters, right? Because if the question is, does the offense or the statement relate to 109A, you got a really hard argument to make because, you know, for the reasons Judge D has described. The challenge is that it's a slightly different question of whether the investigation related to 109A. I mean, we know for sure that it did. But at least in theory, you could have asked a sexual question in a drug investigation or some other public corruption investigation. And so I took your point to be that the government needed to prove that the investigation was related to 109A and that's just, you know, might be true. In fact, we all know it's true, but we don't have that in the indictment and we don't have that before the jury.
That's correct, Judge Richard. My point was that the jury instruction that was given to the jury did not define sexual act for this particular count. It also did not include any language in the instruction that included as an element that the matter, in your case, be related to 109A.
Can I ask a related question to that then? You seem to make a jump here by saying in the 1001 count that the phrase sexual act, it has the definition that is used in the federal code, right, of penetration.
Yes, sir.
But why would we think that as opposed to thinking the term sexual act has its common and ordinary understanding in the context of a discussion with FBI agents and not a legal question? And so the jury was able to interpret sexual act not so limited as the federal code might suggest, but in fact, in the more common and ordinary understanding, which is not limited to penetration.
Well, to answer the question, we don't know. You could be right, Judge Richardson,
that's a legal question, right? So the legal question is, did the jury have to apply the federal code definition? Nobody suggested it. You didn't argue that below. Or was the jury entitled to apply its own understanding of sexual act to whether that statement was false?
I believe that the jury was required to be at least given a definition as to what a sexual act would be. Whether or not that's the code language or whether or not that leaves it up to their interpretation of what sexual act is, they were not given any instruction on the definition.
Did your client request an instruction?
We had no reason to ask for an instruction at that point because when we were arguing in front of the jury, this issue of the 8-year versus the 5-year wasn't on the table. That happened after the verdict. I see my time is almost up. Is there anything else that I can address to the judges?
Judge Floyd, do you have anything else?
No, sir.
Okay. I saw Judge Richardson shake his head no, so I'll take that as a no. Thank you very much, Mr. Gavin.
Thank
we have
you.
Some time left for rebuttal. We'll hear from the government and Mr. Wang.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Christopher Wang on behalf of the United States. The evidence showed and the jury found that Leggins lied to federal agents investigating whether he sexually abused an inmate in an unattended, unsurveilled prison office after hours. None of Leggins' arguments on appeal warrant the overturning of his conviction or sentence on the false statement counts. Now I'll turn to the sufficiency issue because opposing counsel spent much of his time there. There are two independent bases to uphold the Section 1001 conviction. First, that Leggins' policy.
Can you start with the question that I asked your colleague? Your colleague's argument seems to be premised on the idea that sexual act for purposes of this 1001 charge requires penetration. I don't know where that comes from, but what's your interpretation of sexual act? Is it limited by the code's definition, or is it a contemporary ordinary understanding of the jury?
Your Honor, we agree with your position that it's the latter, and we come to that conclusion by looking at both the indictment and the jury instruction. For counts 1 through 4, both the indictment and the jury instruction specifically define sexual acts in terms of the definition in the statutory code. We find no such definition in count 5, either in the indictment or the jury instructions. And to us, it makes sense that you would not limit the definition of sexual act to penetration in the course of determining whether defendant obstructed justice under Section 1001. Certainly, a lie about whether he engaged in any kind of sexual activity at all, regardless if it was penetrative, would have a tendency to influence an investigation into whether he sexually abused an inmate. So, yes, we would agree with
it. And this is maybe a little speculation on your part, but I'll ask it anyway. Is that a theoretical explanation for the otherwise seemingly inconsistent jury verdict?
It is, Your Honor. We think it's quite possible that the jury could not find beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Leggins penetrated BL, but we think that it's, given the evidence in the case, it's quite likely that they did find beyond a reasonable doubt that there was some kind of sexual activity, even though it was not penetrative in that office.
And Mr. Wang, is the enhancement under 1001 an element of that offense?
It's not an element of the offense.
What is it then?
It's a means of increasing a sentence that we have the
Wait, stop. Now, you got plenty of good arguments.
Yeah.
But it is really your argument that it's not an element after Aline?
Let me rephrase. It is an element, Your Honor, and we believe that the factual predicates for the enhancement were established in the indictment. Basically, at the time of the indictment, Mr. Leggins knew that he was a subject of an investigation into possible sexual abuse of an inmate. And you know, as Judge Richardson, as you indicated, it's 1001. You read matter to indicate to be the investigation. Therefore, you look at whether the false statements were related to the investigation related to an offense under Chapter 109A, and they clearly did because they were investigating whether.
So then answer what from the indictment tells us that this investigation was into sex crimes instead of, you know, drugs or, you know, something else.
Well,
how do I know that from the indictment?
The fact that it's mentioned sexual acts three times, the fact that you can look at count number 5 in the context of the entire indictment in which he was being prosecuted in counts 1 through 4 for various sex abuse crimes. We think that.
But that shows the end result, right? But, you know, if they were investigating a drug crime for one reason or another, we might not expect FBI agents to ask about sexual activity in a drug investigation, but we can certainly imagine reasons why it might be relevant. I mean, the trouble I've got, and I get as a factual matter, you're there, but I need to look at the four corners of the indictment and be able to say that the matter I read as investigation was related to a 109A investigation. And I don't see that in the indictment. I certainly don't see that in the jury instruction. But I want you to tell me what am I looking to learn that piece of information?
Your Honor, again, I return to you look at the actual language of count number 5. You've got 3 mentions of a sexual act. You've got the reference to the FBI, the joint FBI DOJ investigation at the time that Mr. Leggins was indicted. He was well aware. He was told at the beginning of the interview that he was a subject of an FBI investigation into possible sex abuse of an inmate at FCI Petersburg.
Right. Now, but again, this is conflating the facts. I get as a factual matter, you got a really great claim.
Yeah.
The problem is, like, the formality matters here, right? And the indictment does talk about sex. It also talks about, computer, online computer and printers, right? So maybe it was a computer crimes investigation for all I know, because it looks at matter and it tells us what the matter is, but it defines the matter as a general matter within the jurisdiction of the FBI. That's it. But it doesn't tell us what kind of matter it is beyond that. And so that's, do you understand my?
Yeah, I do see your issue. I mean, I didn't interpret opposing counsel's argument to argue that the validity of the indictment. I sort of interpreted his argument to focus on the validity of what he was informed at the arraignment.
An Alene error, or an Apprendi error, is fundamentally about what's in the indictment and what's in the jury charge, right?
I mean, that's correct, John.
That's what an Alene error is. So maybe I'll ask one more question and then maybe I'll let my colleagues go. But assuming that I disagree with you on the merits of this, and I think it is an Alene error, first, have you argued harmless error?
We did argue harmless error, that even if he was entitled to the information, the correct information about the maximum statutory sentence, the fact that he did not receive the correct information doesn't make a difference, because he would have, there's no evidence that he would have pled guilty instead of proceeding to trial.
Right, so that's the question I want to ask. And I take it that you did, it seems like you did in your brief, but the question I've got is a slightly different, is what do we look for harmless error? And if you don't know the answer to this, it's fine to just say, I'm not following you. It's totally fine. But there are two lines of cases that we have. One represented by the Supreme Court's decision in Netter that says, if you fail to instruct a jury on an element, we can look at the evidence to see if the error is harmless. And so that's one form of harmless error in this type of problem. And at least in a case called Catone, we apply Netter to Apprendi errors, which are Alene errors. And so is that the harmless error that you're advocating for? Or separately, are you arguing that the error is harmless for some other reason?
Well, we're arguing that the error is harmless because it would not have changed the defendant's trial strategy. I don't know if that falls into your Alene box or not.
Do you believe that you can show harmless error merely by showing the facts that are relevant or uncontroverted and overwhelming? Is that sufficient to show harmless error from your perspective?
We do, Your Honor. With regard to Apprendi, my understanding of Apprendi is that it only applies once the district court passes sentence. And if it imposes a sentence greater than the statutory maximum, then you have to look at whether, the facts that led to that sentence above the statutory maximum were presented to the jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But here we have a sentence that was 54 months, which was below the 60 months statutory maximum for even a standard Section 1001 violation. So I'm not sure how there was any Apprendi violation here.
But he was, Alene says that the error is not the sentence. The error is the improper range, right? And so he had an improper range, hypothetically. I'm not asking you to concede that, but he had an improper range. And normally, if it's under the old statutory maximum, that would be harmless. I get your point. But here, we've got a little bit of a wrinkle because the guideline specifically enhances his sentence as a result of the higher statutory maximum, right? And so what I have a hard time understanding is why that isn't the error, unless, the overwhelming and uncontroverted evidence point gets you out of the box.
Are you talking about the 3-year enhancement from 5 years to 8 years?
I'm talking about the 4 level enhancement as a result of it being an 8-year max offense instead of a 5-year max offense, right? There's a 4-point guideline enhancement, right?
Okay. Yes, the 4 level enhancement of Section 2J1.2. You're talking about. Okay. I think my interpretation of this enhancement is that it applies if so long as the matter is related to a sex offense under Chapter 109, and the matter is the investigation.
Right, so help me understand how I get there, because it says if you're convicted under 1001 and, quote, the statutory maximum term of 8 years applies. Right. So that sounds to me like it's actually referring to whether the statutory maximum term applies, not the underlying facts.
Well, I've got Section 2J1.2. If the defendant was convicted under Section 18 U.S.C. 1001,
would and agree
statutory happened? Maximum term of 8 years imprisonment applies because the matter relates to sex offenses under Chapters 109A and so on and so forth. So what I think how you apply this particular enhancement is you look at the matter, as your Honor previously suggested to opposing counsel, and the matter is an investigation into his possible sex abuse of an inmate, and that related to a sex offense under Chapter 109A. So the four-level enhancement would apply here.
So another, your argument is that it doesn't matter whether the eight-year statutory maximum actually applies. If it could have applied, then you think this section applies?
That's my reading of this enhancement, of this four-level enhancement.
Okay. But I'll stop because I've hogged your time and I want to give my colleagues an opportunity. Do you agree if that reading's wrong that your harmless error fails, or do you think it still depends on the neater point of whether there is uncontroverted and overwhelming evidence?
I don't think it necessarily destroys our harmless error argument. I mean, our harmless error argument is based on, you know, the fact that this whether he was informed of 5 years or 8 years would not have changed the decision to go to trial, because he was facing possible imprisonment of life if he was convicted on these other offenses. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's sort of where we are on.
Mr. Wang, could I, if just throw up so that I understand this, because now I'm a little bit confused, but that's a different harmless error analysis than the one that I think, I don't want to put words in Judge Richardson's mouth, but I think what we're trying to figure out is whether or not there is in fact uncontroverted evidence of the underlying sexual act that Mr. Gaston says completely fails for lack of proof. And so can you answer that question?
Yes, Your Honor. If you take our position is that the sexual act, as Judge Richardson noted, is not necessarily penetrative sex as defined by the statute, but sort of the common ordinary definition of sex that an ordinary juror might apply. And the evidence that we have right here is first the obstructive behavior of Leggins in taking BL into an unattended, unsurveilled office after hours. We have BL's trial testimony. This contemporaneous report of the assault to his cellmate, two FCI officers, and two nurses. We have the DNA evidence, including the DNA of the anorectal swab of BL, the inside of his jockstrap, and the outside of his shorts. And we have the IT manager's testimony regarding the implausibility of Leggins' account of his conduct in that office. So I think if you view all that evidence in the light most favorable to the government, certainly you come to the conclusion that he engaged in a sexual act as the ordinary definition of sexual act and lied about it. And I'd also like to sort of bring up the point that there's another independent basis to uphold the Section 1001 conviction, which is that Leggins falsely stated that he was engaged in quote unquote just conversation with BL while in that office and while he attempted to use a computer. And that there's sort of uncontroverted evidence from the IT manager that no one attempted to log on to the computer during the time that Leggins claimed to be in that office using the computer. And his story of inserting his PIP card and being unable to input his PIP number was implausible. So certainly if this court has certain reservations about upholding the Section 1001 conviction based on the false denial of engaging in sex with any inmate, it certainly could turn to the false statement about engaging in just conversation to uphold the conviction. I'd also like to add that Mr. Gavin, I think, said a lot about about the so-called evidence of how it was implausible to walk the victim through through the corridor, only 315 seconds into raping for 5 minutes. Certainly that was an argument in that, and all that evidence that opposing counsel presented to the jury that the jury already considered and rejected. And, you know, viewing the light in those favorable to the government, this court should reject as well.
Mr. Wang, yeah. Based on the way the indictment was written, is it possible that the jury was convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that he did lie about the computer, and they just glossed over the sexual nature?
Well, the
they weren't told you've got to find the computer lie and the sex act. So is it possible that when they got to the computer, they just found him guilty, and that's the end of it?
It's possible, Your Honor. It's impossible to speculate about what exactly.
No. There's a special verdict form, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Right? And the special verdict form, they have to check which lie, either or both, and they check both statements as being lies.
That's correct. I was interpreting Judge Floyd's comment. I mean, maybe they just glossed over the second lie after finding the computer lie and just didn't give it much thought and checked yes. But we can't really speculate about what the jury was thinking. We have to look at the face of the verdict, and the verdict indicates they found both lies, both that he falsely denied engaging in a sex act with any inmate at any time, and that he falsely stated that he was engaged in just conversation with BL. So I think we have to just look at the face of the verdict form and say that we think the jury, you know, did their job and came to those determinations. And basically you can rely on either one to support the Section 1001 conviction. Your Honors, if you have any other questions about, I see my time is running down. If you have any other questions about the sufficiency, the statutory maximum sentence, or the procedural and substantive reasonableness of the sentence, I can answer them now. If you don't, I'll just rest on the briefs and respectfully request this court affirm the conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wang. Mr. Gavin?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Judge Richardson, to address your comments about whether or not this is something that the jury could infer from a common sense approach based on their understanding in the general world of what a sexual act is versus what the statutory definition is. You know, it would be fine, I think, if they had been told you can rely on your own inferences that you obtain from common sense daily activity. But they were only told sexual acts. And sexual acts was defined throughout in counts 1 through 4 uniformly. So there would have been no other way.
Doesn't it say when he gives the instruction, this is my experience. I haven't pulled this particular charge, but don't they say for purposes of counts 1 through 4, sexual act means? And so
they do that in each count.
Right. And so the point being is that means not for, it doesn't say that for count 5. And the sort of reasonable interpretation there means that sexual act means, you know, what a lay person's understanding would be for count 5.
If that was the case, then they would have to have gone beyond the jury instructions that they were given, because there wasn't any definition provided to them, and there wasn't any instruction that was provided to them that would have said.
I mean, they didn't provide instructions. They never provide instructions on every word in an indictment, right? Or the instructions are always subject to interpretation. Right. Why is this different from all the other words that they use?
Because in this
every phrase.
Because in this case, Judge, it was an element. I mean, to get an enhanced penalty, it was an element. I mean, there are 4 elements under the basic offense, but it should have been a 5th element they would have instructed upon to establish that the matter was an offense covered under 109A. They were only given instruction on the first 4 elements.
Mr. Gavin, I'm not saying this is going to be the result, but assume that we uphold the conviction on the computer lie. What would you have us do?
Judge, if you uphold the conviction on the computer lie, then I would have the court at a minimum re-sentence the defendant based on using a 5-year maximum. That may or may not create prejudice to defendant, because I agree that his ultimate sentence was less than the five-year maximum, but the prejudice was the fact that he was given an additional four levels under the sentencing calculus based on it being an eight-year term. So the judge started in the wrong spot. What I would say to you, Judge Floyd, is that I don't know how the computer cannot be intertwined with the sex act, because there's an additional sentence in that indictment. The additional sentence in that indictment basically says, yeah, you lied to us about going to a computer and a printer when you knew you had engaged in a sexual act with the inmate. That's the last sentence. That was not included in Mr. Wang's argument. So the two are intertwined.
Wait. But it says that, but it also says separately that the defendant used an unintended office with no surveillance camera. I mean, that's the point is those go together, right?
Well, I think you have to read it all, but it's like three different clauses to that language in the indictment. So, you know, if we're going to have a special verdict, that's not what they included in the special verdict, because the special verdict form was not that specific, you know, whether it was that part of the clause or whether or not because he had engaged in a sexual act clause or whether or not they were in an unintended office with no surveillance cameras clause. I mean, there's three different parts to that clause, but the underlying premise is that he had knew that he engaged in sexual acts. Frankly, and this is not part of the argument.
I guess this is part of your point, even that last clause says that he used an unattended office with no surveillance camera to engage in a sexual act with the victim. So even that clause is sort of dependent on the jury somehow finding that that was the purpose of using the office.
Correct, Judge Diaz. And if you take that another step, if there was no sexual act established, then who cares why he was in the office? Who cares whether or not he used a printer or whether he didn't? At that point in time, the issue would be that wouldn't be material. I didn't raise that because I believe that they're so intertwined that they are based upon the establishment of a sexual act. That's the root cause of the lie. That's the root cause of the harm. If there was no sexual act, but he lied about just going into an office for a printer, I'm not sure that would be material enough for, you know, a conviction. So that's my thought on the fact that I believed that even though there are two different counts, they both are predicated upon the establishment of a sexual act. And the issue of just the alibi or the cover up is really immaterial to the real substantive act, which is because he had engaged in a sexual act.
So, Mr. Gavin, let me follow up with this is part of Judge Richardson's questions. If we find, in fact, that the evidence sufficient that there was, in fact, a sexual act as required by the code, taking the definition that you say would be required, not just any act, but the sexual act that you say is not supported by the evidence. But if we conclude otherwise, is this Apprendi error harmless?
I don't believe so. I mean, I think the error that Mr. Wang was talking about, whether or not Mr. Leggins would have chosen to plead guilty or not plead guilty if he'd been given the correct statutory max, might be harmless. But the absence of giving the jury all of the elements that were required to get the enhanced penalty under 1001 would be almost plain error under, you know, even under the potential Medley case that you guys have pending now. It would seem to me that that's a constitutional issue under the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, whereas he has a right to have the grand jury indict him with appropriate language, and he has the right to the jury have to consider the appropriate language once written. If Judge Novak essentially changed the form of what the grand jury issued by essentially extending the five-year term to the eight-year term, I think that could be considered under the plain error. I see I only have 30 seconds, Your Honor, so.
My colleagues have any further questions?
No.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gavin. I note that you were court appointed, and so I want to thank you especially for taking this case on. I think your client was very ably represented by you today, both here before us and on the papers. And Mr. Wang, thank you as well for representing the government's interests. As you probably know, in normal times, we would come down and shake your hands and thank you personally. We can't do that, but hope to do that again real soon. But in the absence of that, you have the thanks of myself and my colleagues for your able work on this case. So thank you very much.
Thank you, judges.